everybody. Welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of April 10th, 2024. I am Charles Hain. I'm here with Gigi Hawkins.
Hey there.
Jason Hellerman.
Good morning.
We have one topic this week, which is the dry desert that is the film industry right now and how we're all going to survive until 2025. So we're going to be talking about historical precedents for this kind of thing. We're going to be talking about how we got here and how we're hoping to get out. We're going to be talking about mental health care. And we're going to be talking about all that this week on the No Film School podcast, because it is a bad time. But we've been through them before and we'll be through them again. And there's ways we can navigate it.
And we'll wrap up with how we can continue to be creating and be creative during these
bad times. Absolutely end on an up positive note. That's this week on the No Film School podcast. All right. So this week, survive till 25. What does that mean? Why is everybody saying it? So last year we had a strike and everyone was like, oh, we're on strike. This sucks. But there's this thing about a human being where it is easier to tolerate something when you know it is going to end.
Yeah.
We all knew the strike was going to end. And there's a thing where you're like, you know, if I'm going on a run and I know I'm going to do 20 miles and I get to 20 miles and then all of a sudden reality bends and I have to do 8 more, I'm like, fuck those 8 more. But if I always knew I was doing 28, like your expectations manage for that, right? I definitely remember, like, in LA, I did a bike ride out to Malibu once and I did a wrong turn. I went through the wrong canyon and I thought I had an hour left and I had 3 hours left. And
I was like,
motherfucker, motherfuck this shit. I had to do the 3 hours left and it was great, but it was like not what I thought I was doing. And that's the situation we're in now. I think a lot of people were hoping the strikes would end and we'd be right back to work. But for a variety of reasons, some of which are film related and some of which aren't, 24 is not picking up. One of the big film related reasons is the IATSE contract is up this summer. It looks like there's not going to be an IATSE strike, but while it was possible, a lot of the bigger studios were like, well, let's not be mid-production if there's a strike, right, guys? Mm-hmm. And then outside of the film industry, interest rates went up. And one of the things people forget about when interest rates go up is when interest rates go up, businesses can't get cheap money as easily. And so a lot of the streamers, which, like, money was basically free for 10 years. From 2010 to 2020, if you were a business, money cost $0. And so streamers could greenlight all these shows. And, like, the fact that we didn't build more infrastructure and bridges is heartbreaking. But I'll, like, among my list of things that pissed me off about Obama, separate conversation. But we got a lot of great television out of it, which isn't as good as bridges, but it's close. But now that interest rates are up, investors want companies to actually make money, not just make things. And so the streamers are all being much more conservative. They're being more careful about what they greenlight. Netflix is doing a lot more reality content, like lower budget shows, more volume shows. But even in reality, because I have a lot of friends who work in, you know, we call it unscripted, not reality, but I have a lot of friends who work in that space, and that space is still pretty slow. Although I have heard a lot more rumblings in unscripted lately. Like, I know a lot more people who are like, it's picking back up in unscripted. But it's still slower than it would have been a couple of years ago. And so it's a multi-whammy punch of the COVID threw a wrench in some things. And then as we picked up and started to get going again, we had the 23 strikes. And now the looming 24 strikes and higher interest rates and all this stuff means that work is epically slow. And it's terrifying.
It's really scary.
Now, the thing I went through in 2020, which I shared with all my students, which I'll share with everyone again, is I'm old enough that this is not my first, the end of everything. Mm-hmm. In 2001, it felt like, what the fuck, after the World Trade Center attack and chaos and the internet and dot-com crash. In 2008, I literally remember being in a post house, Boxer Films, they're now out of business, so I can say their name, and like, it was silent. Mm. I was like, what the fuck? And I like found someone in the, it was like a completely empty office. And then I like found someone in the office and he was like, yeah, there's no work. Every client is just watching their portfolio tank. I think we should all go hunt deer. And like, we're just like, oh, I guess it's over. I guess capitalism is done. Okay. So like, it's not the end of everything. The industry continues on. People like watching content. People like watching movies. It's not done, but it's terrifying. And I'm going to say this. Usually as you get older, time seems to move faster. Like, I feel like I just had a kid and she's five. The 2008 thing, but that all happened in August. And by 2009, like, work was back. Mm-hmm. It is a fucking long ass time at this point where work has been this slow. And I would imagine if I was 28, not 44, it would feel like infinity time that work has been this slow.
Like, is this and the new normal?
So, like, I want to have a lot of empathy for people who are freaking out because it's bad and that sucks. And it is bad right now and that sucks. And so as much as I can say, like, I personally believe it will get better because I have a lot of historical examples of it getting better. And we have the recent example of 2020. There wasn't a lot of work. And then by 21 and 22, things were back to normal. So, like, but, like, it sucks. And no one should be saying it doesn't suck. The other thing I always like to think about is Nicholas Ray. So Nicholas Ray had personal problems. This isn't all his fault, but I mean, this isn't all history. Some of it's his fault. He fucked up a lot. But I remember I watched In a Lonely Place in grad school, and that movie slaps, and everybody should go watch that. And like Nicholas Ray made In a Lonely Place and Johnny Guitar, and he made A Rebel Without a Cause, which is like an era-defining movie. And, you know, shit still got so bad for him that by the late 60s, he was living in like a commune in Berkeley, and then he had to take a teaching job in Binghamton, New York in the early 70s because he had no other moves. And I remember reading his Wikipedia page after watching In a Lonely Place and being like, oh, this is just an unpredictable industry.
Yeah.
You have hot streaks and cold streaks, and you can make, like, those three movies are like, that's a fucking resume. Like, go watch Johnny Guitar, my God. Or In a Lonely Place, Bogart's best performance. And you can still end up teaching at SUNY Binghamton, which is fine, but Binghamton's nice. They've got a special sandwich called Speedy. He was probably eating some Speedies, Nicholas Ray. He also had substance abuse problems. He burned some of his own bridges. His wife left him for his son. That probably had some baggage. Like, it look on Gigi's face. Yeah. I mean,
that's some Oedipal.
There's something there. Twist. There's something. That's Electra, right?
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it probably knocked him out of bidding a couple jobs. But, you know, it's an unpredictable career where people bounce back and do things and come around again, and momentum dies for reasons unrelated to you. So it's, I've been thinking about Nicholas Ray in Binghamton a lot lately for whatever reason. Also because I go to Binghamton.
So much of Hollywood contracting is something that just we personally don't have control over, right? Like, I didn't tell the streamers to drastically overspend to try and get subscribers.
You didn't tell Jerome Powell to raise interest rates? That wasn't Jason Hellerman?
Jason, exactly. I thought, oh, okay, got it.
Despite what the emails I get may say, it was not on my priority list to get that done. You know, and I think we can feel, it's easy to feel powerless. There's also a lot of consolidation in Hollywood. The other C word that I don't use when I stub my toe. But it's consolidation's happening, right? Like, is Warner Brothers for sale? That's like been the question, honestly, since Zaslav started making some of these cost-cutting moves. You know, are Universal going to buy them? Is there another thing? We know that Paramount is for sale. There's a big conglomerate called Apollo that's already made a bid. There's David Ellison that's made a separate bid. There are people who are bidding for parts. You know, like, we want CBS. We don't want Paramount Plus. We don't want these things. What can we combine? You know, it is a weird time. Paramount Plus is already combined with Showtime. Disney and Hulu finally made their merger complete last week. And now the Disney Plus Hulu app, if you could have both, but it's sort of a moot point because you're basically paying for a package. Everything's changing as things consolidate, jobs disappear. There's been massive layoffs. I follow this really cool in parentheses. Elaine Lowe is a reporter for The Ankler, and she's just doing weekly emails about the state of the industry and jobs. Like, where is their growth? Where is there not? And there's growth in video games and certainly some growth in tech, but a lot of it's just like, hey, we're slashing jobs and we're not replacing with anything. Obviously, there's the fear of AI. We've talked about that ad nauseum on this. Is it going to replace different jobs? What jobs is it coming for? Can, you know, part of what people went on strike for last summer, both the writers and the actors, was to make sure AI wasn't replacing them on set or doing different things or, you know, negatively impacting them there. There's like, you know, a whole waterfall of what feels like just things you have no control over. And I think, like, for me, when you read all these headlines, you go through these articles, there was a huge Hollywood Reporter article last week on how slow the TV writing industry is, right? It used to be there'd be 10 or 15 pilots that were being greenlit and those rooms were being, you know, built, and you'd have, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 people in each room. So, you know, you're having hundreds, if not thousands of people staffed. And this year, I think there's like three pilots going. You know, if you didn't have your other shows happening, people are out. The room sizes are shrinking. Thankfully, the WGA put in a lot of clauses to make sure they couldn't go back down, you know, down even further. But I do think it's like what can I do then? Right. That's what I always look at. Like when your back's against the wall, like how do I continue to push forward in my dream? You know, while all these business things are happening, and also like with empathy, right? Like I'm so many mm-hmm. of my friends, I'd say the majority of my friends out here are not writers and directors, but they're executives or people who I came up with as an assistant who do this, you know, empathizing with their struggles. You know, it's like people who are working in fear of keeping their jobs, right? I have to keep my job because there's yeah. not other jobs available. You know, it's not like I can't leave Sony and go to HBO if both places are slashing. I can't be at Warner Brothers, you know, what used to be the most powerful and prestigious studio, and then hope that Universal is not going to buy me and the person who's doing my job over there would keep their job and I wouldn't. You know, we saw CAA and ICM merge last year, and you know, CAA slowly and quietly has been trimming the agents, you know, going down mm-hmm. with the, oh, we won't fire you when we merge. And now you're a year in and they're just, oh, we're just going to get rid of that division that happens to be all of these ICM people. So that was a long way of just listing bad things. But yeah, go ahead, Gigi.
I'm glad that you both sort of bring up this idea of what is in our control and what's out of our control, because it's very easy to become incredibly overwhelmed by the stuff that is out of our control. And I just wanted to share, you know, during the pandemic, I was already planning for a career transition. I had saved up for some time, but I found myself in a position where I couldn't afford to live in LA. So I moved back home with my parents for a couple of months. And that was something where I think if it wasn't a pandemic, it would have been incredibly difficult to swallow that. I think I would have felt like I had failed and it had been a huge step back. But looking at what is in our control during this time, and especially like being mindful of, you know, the budget that you have and being realistic, you know, I had a friend reach out to me the other day who was on the verge of losing his apartment and got into the final six for a job interview with like 700 people and then didn't get it and is applying for, you know, any type of job outside of the industry so he can stay in LA. But during this time, I think we have to accept that, you know, there are sort of these things that are simply out of our control, and it's okay for us to do what we need to do to get by. And when I moved back in with my mom and my stepdad and my grandparents up in Santa Rosa, California, it actually ended up being a time where I did a lot of like nourishing of family connections and rebuilding those relationships. And I look back at this last year where I haven't been able to be with my family because I've been working at the movie, and I'm so grateful for that time. In addition to that, I was writing a ton. And I think that, and I was working as an assistant to a writer. And I think that time let me build my portfolio. And we need to see, I think the more and more I understand how to have a career in this industry and figure out how I can have a career in this industry is looking at it as seasons. So there will be quiet seasons, there will be writing seasons, there will be seasons of boom and bust. And I think that we can understand if we look at what season we're in and we can adjust to what's in our control and understand what's out of our control, it will create stability even in this volatile time.
Yeah. I mean, I think the huge power that you just talked about moving back in with your family is also a power of embracing humility and yeah. ego. Mm-hmm. Like I remember I had a friend who got laid off and they were like, I feel so bad about taking on unemployment. Like, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. And I was like, why the fuck not? Like,
yeah.
I took unemployment in like my mid 30s. I had a period in between two gigs where I was like, fuck it.
I'm taking yeah. unemployment. I've been this on is my food money. Stamps before. Like yeah. it's, you do what you have to do.
Well, but it's not even, it is, you do what you have to do, but also these are services that are set up that are available for you that you like, we built this system mm-hmm. for you. Now our unemployment system sucks and that the numbers seem to have been built in like 1983. And yeah. you're like, this is not actually enough money to do the thing. Yeah. But like, I remember I left California, but I was still filing for unemployment. I had to do this whole thing to do it in California, but I was like staying in a cheaper place to stay for a while. And, mm-hmm. and like the money was actually very useful because, mm-hmm. and it was my money that I had been paying into unemployment as long as I've been working to cover you. And it's so funny because there's some people who have like a baggage about that. And then I know other people who are like, oh no, the second the job wraps, like the second the film's done, the second the writer room's over, the next day I'm in the unemployment office. There's that great picture of Dustin Hoffman in the unemployment office after The Graduate, because you used to have to go in and a paparazzi caught him in there. And he was like, the job's over. You think I'm still getting checks? The job's over. The movie's not out. I'm filing.
Can this that be the picture in the article for this podcast?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Iconic. It's a great photo. I love that photo. And it's like, be unabashed about taking advantage of every resource available. Mm-hmm. And also, you will read some stories about people who are like, oh yeah, it was 1938 and I lost my gig at the studio and I figured out how to survive by going down to the well. And I would sit there by the well and I would wash people's pails for them and they paid me a nickel and I paid my rent. And you're like, it's not 1938, it's 2024. LA and New York are among the most expensive motherfucking places on earth. It's not the film industry's fault they're expensive. It is like zoning problems that have made them expensive. LA was not expensive when I moved there. LA was cheap when I moved there 24 years ago. LA used to be cheap. It is now expensive. It's dumb. Every city, like the last affordable city left is St. Louis. And I love St. Louis. People should check it out. That's one of the places I lived in my time in between LA and New York. But like, don't feel bad that the city is expensive. Don't feel bad that you cannot afford the city right now. And figure out a way to like, is it moving home? Is it like staying with friends? You know, I remember after college, I never ended up doing this, but I had a whole group of friends who were like, fuck it, we're going to Houston. Fuck LA, New York. We're going to Houston. Houston used to be cheap. I hear it's now expensive, which is weird. And I always knew in my mind, I was like, oh, well, I know a bunch of people in Houston. Worst comes to worst, I'll just go to Houston for a year, hang out with some college friends. And so like, if you have a bunch of college friends who move somewhere cheap, like, and you can pull up stakes for a year and go there, like, there is no shame in there's no shame in reckoning with reality as it stands. Mm-hmm. And everything about making movies is about learning how to navigate bigger forces than you, right? Like, totally. The exterior cinematography, you can't control the sun. You can put up, like, the sun's going to set when the sun's going to set, and you have to learn to work with it. And the sun and LA real estate are similar. They're going to do what they're going to do, and you have to navigate them however you navigate them to get through this process. And it's also particularly frustrating because right now, the like side scam jobs are also a bitch to get. So it's not like you can like really easily pick up like random temp stuff or like LA has always been a tricky market to pick up side scam things because of all the good looking people. So like, you know, like I have lived places where it's like, oh, I can just like, you know, I'll pick up a couple weeks at a restaurant or retail or like I'll bartend for a bit to get a little cash. But like, every bartending gig in LA, there's like 20 people who are the best looking people in their high school who are like ready to do that job.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember I was desperate for cash once and Hotel Roosevelt had an open bartending call. And so I was like, fuck it. I need some scratch. I'm going to go. And I went and I just looked at the line and I was like, nah, you're not hiring
taking
me.
Taking myself out of this.
Yeah.
Thing.
And like, I'm a fine looking human. I feel very comfortable with myself in my moments. I have some good looking moments, but I don't look like those people. Like those people all look, are good looking for a living and good for them. And like, you know, we all get our gifts.
Just to get into a couple of like specific tactical things that people can do with budget. Cause Charles, you touched on, you know, filing for unemployment. I talked about getting food stamps. There's the very fundamental thing that you should have an emergency fund of at least 3 months of basic cost of living. But like, what else, what are the other things that you guys have done?
This is going to sound like I'm mad at you. I'm not mad at you. I'm mad at society. Where the fuck am I supposed to get 3 months of cash bank account? What the fuck? How the fuck was that supposed to happen? I didn't have like 3 months of padded savings till I was 40. I remember when AOC was going to Congress and Nancy Grace was like, she should have 3 months savings. And everybody was like, she was working as a waitress. Like, where the fuck are you supposed to get that? I was working in the film industry. I had a production company. We're getting nominated for Oscars. And I did not have 3 months of savings cash in the bank. Because no matter how good it got, every time I started making more money, I had to then reapply for income-driven repayments on my student loans. And then my student loans would go the motherfucker up. And so I'm burning like a $1,500 a month on my student loans I'm making slightly more money. And hooray, I'm making more money. And it's just getting eaten by this like giant Leviathan. If you do not have 3 months of cash cushion in your bank account, do not feel bad. You should. It is the good advice. Gigi is saying the right advice. But if you don't, do not feel bad because my God, that shit is hard to put together when you are working freelance. Oh my God.
I'm so glad you said that. And thanks for sharing about like the Sisyphean student loan readjustment thing. I mean, what the hell?
It was so annoying. I was like, I was like, all right, so I'm going to do the honest thing and like give you my tax returns and like actually pay my taxes somewhat correctly. And motherfuck.
That's where you went wrong.
You get married and then you get married and they take your family income into income. And it's like, but my wife didn't go to grad school with me. Why does her and she's not paying my student loans. I am.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I could go on and on about how that shouldn't count. But it is, you know, look, saving is the most important. I tell people that all the time. Like, don't come to LA until you've saved that money. I think it's like really important if you can avoid it. If you can live with your parents for free or with your parents so you're a little older and then go, or live in St. Louis or a cheap place, right? And then come. Mm-hmm. That's always a thing. But if you are here and you are going paycheck to paycheck, I would suggest finding a side hustle pretty quickly. I thought that I was going to be able to write full time and pay my bills. And theoretically, I do that. But it's like, I remember getting to the point in 2018 when I joined No Film School where I was like, I'm sick of really, really hoping I get paid on time, right? Like, I can't be like waiting for these studios to like, you know, it's like 7 months of you're hoping for a paycheck or whatever. And you're like, I've been paid. Even right now, I'll say like, full disclosure, I signed a deal in December. And what is it? April, first week in April. Haven't gotten my money yet. Probably, I talked to my lawyer. He was like, God, I'm hoping we get it by May. You know what I mean? Like, that's 6 months of work that's been done since December. That's kind of the way Hollywood works, right? So like, for me, I was like, okay, now I need to spend time having some sort of steady side thing that became No Film School. There are other things out there, right? Whether it's Uber or Lyft, you know, again, not super easy to get, Instacart, things like that. I have friends who bartend and do different things. In LA, it's hard to get those jobs also because our minimum wage is so high. So if you're a bartender, you have to be paid hourly minimum wage plus you get your tips. So those jobs are really sought after because you can make a lot of money. I think it's like also like change like what I could quit, which is also hard. I worked at a couple of terrible places pre No Film School. I'm so tempted to say their names. Like, I just, you know, but doesn't matter. But like, you get strapped to a job that you really don't want to do because of how bad you need the money. And then the second you don't need the money, mm-hmm. I remember it was like on jury duty and these guys were like hounding me and it was just like maybe the worst situation. And then I booked a rewrite and I was legitimately like, I quit. And even though I knew it was stupid and I got the money quick, I was like, I'll just figure it out and then land it here. So it works out. Having something to do on the side matters, but live with a lot of roommates. I mean, I was talking to some people on Reddit about this, but it's like, I had roommates until I was like 35. Like, and then I moved in with my wife. Like, there's no shame in just having roommates. And honestly, like, it was pretty nice in the struggle to be living with other film and TV people going through the same things, who I also had like the same ideas of like, hey, this is how much we can pay in rent. This is what we should do. And that definitely helped me out.
I love that you're recalibrating what standards, quote unquote, you're supposed to be at a certain time. Like, there's this myth of you have to have this thing done by this age. And if you haven't listened to this incredible episode of The Daily about how it sucks to be 33 and the squeeze of that particular cohort, it made me feel so much better about myself because it was a, you know, nationwide explanation of why it's incredibly hard to get housing and everything else if you're sort of in this particular age group. And in this industry, I think it applies even more. Like, the idea of you should have your own apartment before you get married, for example, like, says who? Is this like, this is the myth of the American dream from the, you know, 50s and 60s carrying over to us, but we are, again, it's not 1930. You're not going to be shining people's pans by the well. It's also not 1957 or whatever, and you're not going to have your own home, and that is okay. That is okay. And I think also, not obviously, comparison is the thief of joy, but comparison for people outside of the film industry is you're setting yourself up for disappointment. And I think we have a very unique situation as filmmakers and people who work in the industry in any capacity and craftspeople who are so used to like cobbling together a career. I mean, I know a production designer who is currently working as at a printing press and also as a handywoman at a gallery. And I admire the chutzpah. I just have to do what I need to do so I can eventually be doing what I want to do. And then that gives her the flexibility to also pick up and show up when somebody calls her at 7 a.m. when she needs to be a production designer or a buyer that day. So I think keeping in mind that we are not in the same industry as our friends who are, you know, did the investment banking or real estate or, you know, insert more stable job and industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's deadly to compare yourself to your friends in their hometowns. I had a buddy once, we're from like a similar rural Maryland area, and we were at a dinner talking and he was like doing stuff. He was repped at CA, he had a short, he's getting a feature going. He like weirdly was made friends with the directors who kept casting him in small parts. He was doing great. And he was like, yeah, man, but LA's a fucking struggle and all my friends from home have boats. And like,
yes.
And I was like, yeah, I don't like half my friends I went to high school with are lawyers and like have a house and a second house. And like, good for you. You're going to be able to weather the thing. Although I hear the law industry is fucked, but whatever. I'm not even going to think about that right now. But it's, you know, it is a real like comparison is the thief of all joy.
Yeah.
And holding yourself to any standard. I always try and remember that like, before 1880, everybody lived at home until they got married, and 80% of people lived at home after they got married. And this fantasy we have that you should be able to have a freestanding apartment by the 1950s is complete horseshit. I had a freestanding apartment for 4 years. It was totally great, but it was the 4 years from 31 to 35. And at 30, I still had two roommates, and it was awesome. And I liked them, and they all worked in film, and we hung out, and we'd go out to parties, and then we'd like, you know, it was great. It was awesome. And I have no, you know, it kept my overhead really low. And keeping your overhead, like the flip side of the 3 months of savings is keeping your overhead as low as you physically can in every way, shape, or form. And, you know, I mean, what drives me wild is, you know, I like cars got really expensive. Yeah. And I, you know, that is also one of these crazy expenses where you're like, oh, wow, it got really expensive to drive. In a way that 20 years ago, it was just like, oh, of course, I'll have a 30-year-old Volvo that I bought for $200 and I'll drive it to set and it won't be a big deal. But again, that's one of those things where you just have to get comfortable with the idea that like, yes, in LA, people judge you by what car you drive, but who gives a fuck?
Yeah.
Like, keep the cheap car.
Try to live close to where you work. I mean, it's like, it's all of the LA real estate right now. I'm in the market for a new apartment. I've been looking and the prices are just so comically bad, you know? And I think like, you can't think about like, oh, I could own a house here. Oh, this is more than all of my friends' mortgage payments. Like, it's like, well, they don't live here, right? It's like very different in different places and even outside LA, although that's probably not, you know, an option for my situation, but it is.
Well, but also this is a North American fantasy. 85% of people in Switzerland rent.
Right.
Like homeownership is this thing that we market to Americans. But like, there are many very happy countries where everyone is a renter.
Yeah.
And it is fine. So like, I don't think landlords exist. That's a podcast for another day. But I don't think we need to build our identity.
That's on our Bridge podcast. Yeah.
But I don't think we need to build our identity in like these outside markers of financial success because, you know, whether we understand, I don't feel like I fully understood what I was committing myself to when I committed myself to this. But I'm still glad I committed myself to this. And like many people, during that year of unemployment, I was like, am I going to leave film? Am I going to try and do something else? And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because I love it too much. I love it too much. It was like, I can't. I like look around. I looked at some other jobs and I was like, no, I don't have it in me. But the thing we love and the thing we devote ourselves to means some trade-offs.
Yes. And piggybacking off of that, because I'm the person who did my plan B first, and when I had my corporate life, I had a studio apartment in Brooklyn. It was small, but it was in a high-rise building above an Alamo draft house. It was amazing. I spent my time outside of working hours writing and learning how to write because I wanted to leave that job so desperately because my heart was not in it. And if you have a creative bone in your body that is driving you towards that, it's really hard to find happiness and satisfaction no matter what the pay is. And it's a very privileged position that I was in because it let me like save up money to then make a career change. But like, I was depressed for half a decade because I was doing a job that looked great on paper. And now I do this job and I'm an aspiring filmmaker, and the struggle is there, and the highs are high and the lows are low, but God, is it worth it? Because I'm doing the thing that I've always wanted to do. And it's so, so wonderful when, like, those little moments along the way where, even if it's a little win, the podcast episode that I wrote and directed, which was the first thing I ever got paid to write and direct, was nominated for a Webby last week. So that's exciting. And those little wins, you have to celebrate them along the way. But yeah, it's if you have that drive there, it's worth servicing and feeding it. And it's worth the trade-off, in my opinion.
So how are we staying creative through the suck? Because look, let's all be real. This is a suck year. Like, work is weird. Like, I actually, I'm doing interesting creative work that I really enjoy and find satisfying, but it's documentary, and documentary is, very satisfying, and I love doing it, and I'm having a blast, and it's a subject near and dear to my heart. But it's not my normal world, but it's a different, but it's a world that's still sort of thriving this year because narrative is so slow, and I think you see a lot of people who don't normally work in documentary working in documentary this year, to be honest. I think that's been it's been interesting to see that pivot out of a lot of people I know. But, and as much as I love documentary, there's not enough documentary work to go around for everybody, unfortunately. Although I do think one of the things I can suggest is going out with whatever camera you have, and it could be a phone camera, and creating documentary projects to keep your creative energy and juices flowing.
Yes.
I think that one of the things that's really important to realize is that, there's a thing I think a lot of people do where they're waiting for outside people to give them the resources, the support, or whatever. And what they're really looking for is outside people to give them the checkmark of approval. And we all fall victim to this. This is human. But really, we're creative artists and filmmakers, and we should just be making things all the time. And that can be, yes, your aspiration is to do studio-level work. No shame. But, look at the first things Greta Gerwig. She just made things. And then eventually those got bigger and bigger and bigger. But she was just like, no, I'm making things. Mm-hmm. I continue to make things. And I would say that a good thing to do on a year like this can be to make a thing. Mm-hmm. And frankly, if you do not have the energy or bandwidth or will to do it because you're spending so much time making cash flow jobs work, writing a thing can be a rewarding thing to do that you can, the same thing that was true when you first got out of school where you're like, all right, I'm going to write 2 hours every day before I go do whatever other job I do to pay the bills. You can still do, even if you are at a different age, because it's still satisfying and you're a different person and you're growing and developing. Gigi?
That hour or 2 hours every day, that is not only satiating the creative desire that you have, but it is an investment. If you can't be investing money, you can be investing your energy and your creativity into your future career. So when things pick up, in 2025, when things are alive again, you have that next project that you can share. And one of the biggest, blessings of the pandemic was I had a short that wasn't working, and I had all this footage, and I took it, and I had through the Brooklyn City College film program that I was in, free premiere, and I learned how to edit. And that was something that was in my control, and I'd spend my nights and weekends learning how to edit. And so whether it's writing or learning something that can help you as a storyteller in the future, I think have one thing that you're working towards that is satiating that creative desire. Or it could be it sounds so cheesy because people recommend this all the time during the good times and the bad times, but just go out and make things, make them on your phone, make short form things. You can even, as long as you're creating and as dark as times get, you protect that finite amount of time where you can be creating. I think you will continue to be moving forward.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the currency to get those studio jobs is still having things finished, right? I read so many people are just like, I have to have the right idea and then I don't know what it is and blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but you also just have to put it on paper. If I had a nickel for every person who's like, I just have to sit down and do it. I'm like, yeah, you do. Like that's, that's it. It doesn't, you know, whether we're in feast or famine time, the exact same way in the door is either I made this movie and, you know, I gave myself permission to direct. Here's my low budget indie that hopefully I can spin into a higher budget indie that I can spin into a studio job, right? That's the way in. But it's finished things. It's not, here's this idea I had. Same thing with scripts. Hey, like, I don't, nobody, especially in the famine time, is buying an idea, right? So like, put it on paper, sit down and finish your spec. There's so much free information out there, you know, on the No Film website, on John August's website, like on different things. Like, you can finish your spec right now. I think Dan Kunkka, writer, always famously hashtag write your spec is his big thing. Like, write your spec. You're just writing your own lottery ticket and hopefully getting better each time you sit down in front of the computer. So like, you know, even if it's incrementally, do it. This is the time, you know, while you're insulated, while things aren't going, you can still push your career forward. Now, you don't want to get into 2025 and be like, oh, now we'll all start because it seems like things are going correct for Hollywood. It's like, no, you want to start like when you have the idea, the impetus, because the thing is, nobody really cares when you break in. They just care that you did it. And if you are just putting off trying or doing whatever, you're not moving forward at all. You're wasting a year of your life. It doesn't matter if Hollywood decides to slow down and flush 2024, which I don't think they are. I think it's just a slower, more lean year. But you don't have to. You can work on your different stuff. We talked about this in the article I wrote in Survivor 25, but like, there's still a lot of foreign film grants. There's different things. You know, a lot of states in the US are upping their filmmaking incentives. You know, like, there's really good numbers. You can look that up on, you know, film.org and different things. Like, there's plenty of ways around this. And if you do things low enough budget, you're not even going to need those, right? You could do it outside the system, do different things like Charles said, figuring out your documentary approach, or, you know, doing that ultra low budget indie, which, you know, Gigi has done, and we had the Wine Club guys on. That's what they did. There are certain ways. And the nice thing is, when you come out of these famine type years, there's going to be a huge appetite for content, right? New things. Executives tell me all the time, like, we're not greenlighting things. So we're looking at who's made what, you know, what can we acquire? What can we do? Is there a script that we think is finished that we can shoot right away? And again, these are finished things. They're not ideas in your head. So, you know, it can be depressing to hear all this stuff, to do whatever, but now is the time to actually do what you set out to do.
The other thing to remember is that there's one finite resource in Hollywood, and that is celebrity. And if you have an amazing idea for a movie, and the only person who could make that movie work is Ryan Gosling, and you write Blue Valentine, you can spend 5 years of your life waiting for Ryan Gosling to have the hole in his schedule to make Blue Valentine, which I believe it was 4 or 5 years they waited, and they kept getting bumped and kept getting bumped. And then he was able to do it, and Michelle Williams was in it, Blue Valentine, great movie. If you have a movie that is perfect for Ryan Gosling in your head, A, you have to write the fucking movie, because you're not going to get to just pitch an idea to Ryan Gosling unless you have a track record. But B, Ryan Gosling would like to still keep making movies, and all of the celebrities would like to keep making movies. And if there is a year where there are fewer streamers and fewer studio movies, that is also a year in which some of those actors will have more time in their calendar to do weird indies. And we have seen historical track records in the past where some of these slower years, like, look, this doesn't solve the problem, because a big studio film or a big streaming film has a crew of 100 people and they're working for 7 months, whereas that little indie feature is going to shoot for 4 weeks with a crew of 20. So it's not going to like put everyone back to work, but it is not a bad year to be out there with a project that like the part is strong enough to attract a real actor, and they're going to have bigger holes in their schedule because they are not committed to 8 months of a streaming TV show or a big, you know, like if you want Colin Farrell in your project, it's an easier year and next year to probably get him as the town is slower. So I would really keep that in mind as you think about like strategies for things. That doesn't solve everybody's problem. If you are below the line crew, the fact that more indies are going to get made this year is a bummer, not a excitement, because the crews are just smaller and the shoots are shorter. But yeah, those are, I think, sort of the big takeaways is repivoting to your creative practice and trying to find the way to use it as an opportunity to reconnect with what you're excited about by the industry in a way, while you also cash flow what you need to do. And don't be like, I remember when I was thinking about leaving LA, someone's like, you know, LA will always still be here. Mm-hmm. Like, you can come back anytime. I haven't yet. I haven't even visited in 5 years, but I visited a lot the first couple of years. There was a year I was back 4 times. I had a wedding and I had 3 jobs, and you know, the transition was what it was. But like LA and New York, they'll always be here. The real estate markets will always be complicated. I don't know, life. I might end up back in LA again if things align correctly. Unlikely, possible. So, yeah, I mean, I love to tell this story. I have a friend who went to Burning Man and fell in love. And director, talented guy, went to Burning Man, was like, you are it. She was like, well, I work at the British Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan. And he was like, all right, fuck it. I'm giving up film for love. And knowing this woman for like 3 weeks, moved to Kabul, Afghanistan to be with her. And his directing career took off in Afghanistan. He ended up getting nominated. I mean, the film that my production company produced was his film that got shot in Kabul, Afghanistan, that he did there, got nominated for an Oscar, led to big things, led to meetings, led to all these things in Afghanistan because he followed his heart and found all of these new opportunities and found this creative reinvigoration and was willing. Like, I remember right before he left, where he was like, yeah, career will be whatever career will be. I've got to see what this is.
Sure. Yeah.
And went where it was. And then career took off because of it. They broke up and he stayed in Afghanistan for 2 more years because he'd built a production company there. He eventually came back to the States. But like, you know, the world is a strange place. And now more than ever, the idea that you have to live in the west side of LA is, yeah, I mean, it still matters. LA is still a place you should go. But you do not necessarily have to live in that 4 square mile block that is the Hollywood film industry for the entire time you are pursuing your career.
Totally.
If you're open to living anywhere, you might as well move there. It's great. But if you're like, oh, I can't afford this right now, I'm going to go to Kansas City for a second and I'll be back. There is zero shame in that.
Yeah, I mean, so many people are going to Austin. It's crazy. Every time I talk to Jordan, who's a no film school writer, and he's in Austin, it's just like, I feel like we suddenly have like mutual friends just from all the people who left LA that went there. And there's definitely places to go. Los Angeles is the mecca, right? It is sometimes important if you are going to be a full-time grip. I think maybe you get the most work here, but maybe not anymore, right? Because you could go to Atlanta, you could go to New York. You know, there's you used to be able to live in Louisiana until that their tax incentive changed, right? It's like, you know, people are going to be shooting different things, different places. There's just a lot of stuff. So, you know, research your markets, look into it, look into those secondary markets, talk to people. And then again, like, figure out your budget, keep your overhead low. Those are the big things. And if your overhead has to be high because you have kids or do different things, then, you know, explore what are those opportunities can be. It's a tough time. It sucks. I feel so bad for all the below the line people. And when things slow down, you know, when there's a threat for a strike or when there's whatever, it's like, you know, I could just hear like the catering people being like, I don't know what to do. And the Ankler did a good thing where they visited a prop master, like the biggest prop master in the world in Burbank, and was just like, we're not doing anything right now. We're doing, you know, some like a John Wick spinoff and we're making like 15,000 rubber guns for that. But other than that, like, we just don't have anything to do. And that stuff's depressing. There's not much we can do about it except hope the tides turn. And also like try to make things, hire those people, rent those cameras, get those caterers, you know. And again, some of it's what's in our purview and our reach. And then, you know, donate to the, you know, entertainment community fund, different stuff like that. If you feel so inclined, but yeah, we're all in this together. Survive to 25. It doesn't mean survive alone, right? It's talk to your friends, work with your friends. This is the perfect time. You had a friend you wanted to work with, try it out, free year, you know?
And let us know how you are planning on surviving this year. We want to hear from you. We're here as a resource. Ask us questions. If you need to just vent, our inboxes are open. So thank you for listening.
All right, guys. Good luck surviving until 25. I'm, as always, not really on the internet, but you can sort of find me places if you look real hard. Where are y'all?
I'm at Lost in Graceland and at ggHawkins.com. And we have some exciting, as I mentioned on the intro last week for our Sam Hargrave episode, we have some exciting Shogun coverage. So binge the show. We'll be talking about it next week, and we'll be interviewing the DPs of the series after that.
At Jason Allerman on Twitter and Instagram, jason@nofilmschool.com. If you choose to email me, if you email me, I like getting nice ones, you know? If you hate me,
be nice to Jason.
Yeah, just leave it on Twitter. There's nothing I can do about it. You know, you could hate. I don't care. But it's very funny. I print out every hate mail I get, I literally print it out and I put it on my fridge so my wife can see it when she gets home so that I can choose what we watch on TV. You know, I'm like, look at them. You're a nurse. You probably didn't have a bad day. Here's a mean email I got working from home. let's watch Shogun. They just boil a guy alive in the first episode. You'll love it.
I know.
Yeah. Email me. We'll figure this out. Please ask questions, and we'll try to be a resource in this time and keep you updated. And when the feast years hit, we'll be here to celebrate with you too.